Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, June 18, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Margaret Duffy. On our program this week, they're voting tomorrow to replace Eric Cantor as House Majority Leader. His defeat in the primary to a little-known Tea Party candidate took many by surprise, but should it have? Chelsea Clinton took home a $600,000 paycheck during her stint reporting for NBC News, and we'll see some tremendous examples of native advertising in the New York Times, content sponsored by Netflix and Hewlett-Packard. At the same time, though, there's some questions about a lack of transparency about Sunday night's CNN documentary, 41 on 41. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but let's start with the resurgence of violence in Iraq. The situation there is fluid. The militant group ISIS, Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, continues to move toward Baghdad. The U.S. embassy is evacuated of inessential workers, and President Obama has committed 275 troops to the region. All indications are we could be back on our way to war in Iraq. The coverage is bringing back some familiar names and faces to our television sets. Just ask The Daily Show's Jon Stewart.
Because I think we all know four wrongs make a right. And in this current crisis, the news media has rushed to get the band back together again. And they all have the same advice. On bass, sickly wrong about everything, Bill Kristol. On drumming up support for endless war, Paul Wolfowitz. On guitar, are you kidding me? How does this guy keep getting booked on television? Lindsey Graham.
The stubborn-headed president we have, who thinks he knows better than everybody else, who withdrew troops. Stubborn-headed, delusional, detached president. But that's the last bad thing I'm going to say.
Last bad thing that he's going to say. I don't want to necessarily talk about what's going on in Iraq, because that situation is so fluid. I want to talk about who's talking about it. We saw there Lindsey Graham, Paul Bremer, Paul Wolfowitz. It's like Back to the Future.
Well, yeah, and I can understand some criticism. I mean, why do we go to these same guys? Partly it's because journalists are lazy. We have our Rolodex. We know the same people we go back to. And we also like people who give really succinct emotional sound bites. And these characters have done that for the past decade. So it makes sense to go to talk to them about at least it makes sense in the journalism world to go talk to these folks about the current situation. That being said, I mean, I get the criticism. I could see why we ought to have other people. But who would these critics like us to talk to in the media instead of McCain and Romney, who, well, okay, they ran for president against Obama, right? Or Lindsey Graham or John McCain, who are leading voices in the Senate against the president's foreign policy. Who would they like us to talk to instead? Nobody, maybe. And that's not how journalism works either.
Well, maybe we could propose college professors, just as a thought. I also thought it was interesting that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert consistently show people making assertions, these politicians making assertions, and then they juxtapose it with video from the past saying exactly the opposite thing. Why do fake journalists do that? I mean, I really wonder. And the real responsible journalists don't do that.
And let it go.
And let it go. Like, oh, okay. They try to pin him down and they're like, no, I'm not going to talk about it.
I mean, I think the thing that disturbs me more than anything is that the coverage this week just shows how little we have changed since 9/11 and the war in Afghanistan and Iraq in terms of the political divide that's there. We have the very same players, left, right, and in between, using the very same playbook. We've really learned nothing, either as journalists or as a society in those 10 years. Sometimes it feels like it anyway.
Okay, well, Tomorrow, there's going to be a special election in the U.S. House of Representatives. Virginia Congressman Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, is stepping down after losing to Tea Party candidate David Brat in last week's primary. When it became clear last Tuesday night that Brat was going to walk away with the nomination, it was a big shock, unless, of course, you live in Richmond, Virginia. See, that's because the voters in the district knew Cantor spent little time currying their favor. He raised big money outside the district and just didn't spend the time there. The Richmond papers were on top of it, but national publications, even ones with strong D.C. presence, never thought to look at whether the majority leader was taking care of business at home. David Carr basically called this the Beltway's blind spot in journalism, being only 30 miles away from Richmond and pretty much ignoring this race entirely.
Well, it did seem like a long shot. One of the things that I think is most interesting about this is Cantor did two different polls in May, I believe, both of them were, and showed him 30 points up. Now, given the last election, we realize that the Republicans sometimes have a polling problem. They need to probably return to the bean counters. But I bet it did seem to the Washington press and a lot of other people that, you know, this is really just going to be a flash in the pan. In fairness, though, I've got to say that trying to poll in open primaries is a hugely difficult job. They need to bring Nate Silver or somebody back to do that kind of thing.
So you have the problem with the polls, and you have the problem with journalists relying too much on the internet, or in the case of Washington-related news, on whatever is going around in that bubble of the Beltway, as you talked about. But I mean, I think there's a couple of other problems, too, that this story really is a good case study of. I mean, one, the level of reporting at the local level has always been more accurate with regard to these kinds of stories than at the national level. Unfortunately, local media are in real trouble, and they're cutting back, as we've said many times on this show, in government reporting and regional coverage of all kinds. And if we can't help local media figure a way out of that, these stories are never going to be covered well. And I guess the other thing that kind of, you know, bothers me about this whole thing is just that we ignore in the media sometimes, and Washington political reporters of the mainstream media ignore talk radio, except when, you know, there's a particular blow up, if Rush Limbaugh says something stupid or whatever. But Laura Ingraham and Glenn Beck and Mark Levin, they drove this race and probably made up for all that money that Eric Cantor had against Brat. They helped him win, and yet nobody saw that because they always discount talk radio.
So is that something that we should be, as journalists, starting to also be watching and listening to a lot more? I know one of the things that I talk to students about here in terms of their habits and how – our journalism students and their habits and how they're consuming news, very few of them are listening, say, to KBIA when they're in the car, unfortunately. We need to get them back into the tent a little bit. But even fewer, say, are listening to KFRU, where some of those other more right-leaning talk shows are playing on a daily basis, and not necessarily saying listen to it every single day, but to sample from time to time and hear the voice of the people, hear what people calling in have to say as much as anything else.
See, I think that point and Mike's point are really important ones, because very few people are really willing to expose themselves to points of view which they find distressing. There's a whole cognitive dissonance thing going on there. But I think it's really important for not just journalists, but for citizens to be paying attention to what other folks are saying in the media that aren't their particular favorites.
Yeah, and I think journalists are just as guilty as anybody else. I mean, reporters hear what they want to hear. They heard this narrative early on in the primary process about, look how the establishment Republicans are squashing the Tea Party because they want to win big in November. They had a couple of examples. A couple of examples do not make a trend, and here's a counterexample.
Well, how much is a fresh new feature reporter worth to a broadcast network? If her name is Chelsea Clinton, upwards of $600,000. NBC hasn't confirmed the political report that broke that figure last week, but it hasn't denied it either. Chelsea Clinton's work wasn't anything we would likely consider extraordinary. She did a sit-down interview with Judy Blume last summer when Judy Blume was promoting her new movie Tiger Eyes, did a couple of feel-good features. Anything you'd say worth $600,000, though?
Well, I'd kind of put it in context. Television is, and even television news, particularly at the national level, is about celebrities. And the Clintons and the Bushes and even McCains and so on are celebrities. What their kids do is interesting and adds some cachet to what seems to be going on. To put it in context, I made a note here. Yeah. Oh, just how did Luke Russert get his job?
Luke Russert, also the son
powerful
of
people
Tim
who
Russert.
Have connections. Yeah, and I'm not saying that any of them are bad reporters or bad at what they do, but they sure got a nice in.
Absolutely. Luke Russert, though, his connection being his father with some kind of a legacy with journalism,
right,
as opposed to Chelsea Clinton, whose parents obviously Bill and Hillary Clinton, Jenna Bush Hager, daughter of George W. Bush and Laura Bush.
I mean, you know, is Chelsea Clinton a journalist? No. I mean, just watch any one of the stories that she's produced for NBC, and you'll know the answer to that.
They're on not
the
other very good.
No, they're not very good. Watch the interview that she did with the Geico Gecko. It is horrible. I mean, it's so bad.
Well, but Diane Sawyer did do a sock puppet interview. I just want to remind you of that one.
But, you know, even so, I mean, let's face it, life isn't fair, and business certainly isn't fair, and journalism is a business. And if NBC News is getting something out of their $600,000 investment, fine. Are they getting a new and different audience? I don't know. They don't appeal to me. Maybe those stories appeal to some people. Are they getting connections that can lead to more revenue? They're sure in deep with the Clinton family. I mean, remember, they were going to do a whole mini-series about Hillary Clinton last year that got canceled after people were complaining about it. It's getting them access, and my guess, that's worth $600,000 to NBC News.
But just to put it in context, Matt Lauer makes $25 million a year.
Yeah.
Bill O'Reilly makes $20 million. A website has also figured out how much they pay per viewer. So Bill O'Reilly's audience is getting $6.67 per viewer. Robin Roberts, down at the bottom here, makes $6 million, and she brings in $1.30 per viewer.
And by the way, just to reinforce Margaret's point about celebrity, I mean, this story is related in some ways to our first one. You talk about going back to the same old people over and over and over again. We may have Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush running for president in a few years. And, I mean, our culture appreciates celebrity, old celebrities and dynasties, and that's why we're here.
Maybe able to use old bumper stickers.
We all have our Clinton-Bush bumper stickers from back in the day.
Oh, by the way, this morning on the Today Show, it was being hosted by Willie Geist and Natalie Morales. From the
Willie Geist, also the
son of Bill
Geist,
a
Missouri grad. Yes,
but they're doing it from the Harry Potter theme park event. I mean,
which is interesting because the Tonight Show is also being done
Jimmy
this
Fallon,
week.
Yes,
and being done this week at Universal Studios. So I need to ask you both: have you been watching Orange Is the New Black?
I have seen some of it, but I am not a binge watcher. And
okay,
I will
so you're not fully
that.
Caught up then, right?
No, I'm not.
Okay,
I'm
no,
not.
Spoilers.
No spoilers here.
No spoilers at all. Mike, how about you?
No, I haven't watched it, although maybe I will.
Okay, well, the Netflix series, which is based on Piper Kerman's memoir about her year in a federal prison, has captivated millions, including myself. I am a binge watcher. I am completely caught up. And when you catch lightning in a bottle, the way that Netflix has with that program, why not exploit it, right? Well, late last week, the New York Times launched a multimedia report complete with graphics and audio and video on what life is like for real women in our federal prison system and how the male model of incarceration doesn't work.
I had a Hermes scarf, a Tahari coat dress, a pair of high heels, and that is not really conducive to shackles. And I can remember trying to keep up with everybody because they were all ahead of me and they were moving at a certain pace and I was the only one with heels on.
When they gave us the pillowcase, it had a sheet, it had like a razor, a toothbrush, a bar of soap in it.
Seven underwears, like three bras.
It was filthy. There were wall-to-wall women laying around on the floors. People were withdrawing from drugs. There's all kinds of feces and throw-up and urine.
It was a really, really scary day, and the prison officials made sure that it was extra scary. They really make sure you understand that you have lost control of your life and that they now have control of your life.
The issues pervasive in the Netflix series run through the tea brand piece, but that's no shock given the banner at the top of the website says paid post with the Netflix logo beneath it. As a fan of the program and somebody who frankly is probably a little too interested in prisons, I found myself fascinated by this. I spent probably close to 20 minutes on this page on the New York Times' website, watching all the videos, reading the content, going through the graphics and the other elements. The goal here is that this story really mimics New York Times' regular coverage in a lot of ways.
And they are calling it the snowfall of native advertising, if you remember that great story in the multimedia story the New York Times did a while back. You know, one thing we should remember is a lot of people are acting like we've just discovered fire or opened Pandora's box, and advertorials have been around forever in all kinds of ways. Video news releases have been run on numerous stations. Traditional news releases are being sent out in all kinds of ways, and there are estimates that for some publications, 70% of the content is generated from news releases. So this has always been going on where brands are attempting to at least get themselves involved in the conversation of shaping news. I understand why it is concerning for journalists, because it does seem to be blurring lines more than they ever have been blurred. And you do want people to have confidence, and actually we in advertising want people to have confidence in what they're reading, because that brings credibility to the advertising.
Talk a little bit about where some of those lines are blurred, because, I mean, I was most impressed with this piece and how clear it was that it was paid content, but it was something you could be interested in, still learn from, still glean some stuff from. I thought the New York Times couldn't have been more transparent about how this content came to be.
Well, and this is what we teach in our classes as well, is that transparency is important. But this is the Wild West. There are no real rules. We work very hard with our Institute for Advertising Ethics that's here at Missouri to try to say, look, here are the guidelines for what should happen in a native advertising situation. How clear must it be, and what does that clarity look like? The Atlantic was highly criticized for its Scientology story, which it was not clear that it was really a promotional story.
And we've talked about that one specifically at length on this program.
Well, in fact, last week we talked about another example of what I at least thought was good use of native advertising, that American Express documentary about the plight of the working poor and trying to pay their bills. Sure, there was a reason that American Express sponsored that, but that content was really solid material. Now, do I wish that journalists had done that work themselves instead of somebody paying for it that had a vested interest in it? Sure. But as long as the content is worthwhile, is worth me attending to, I don't really care who pays for it as long as they're transparent about it.
Well, and right now, as we're trying to scratch our way back as an industry and figure out new business models, maybe this native advertising model is what pays for some of that really good storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on whether it works or not, right? I mean, we don't have any metrics, at least that the New York Times has released yet, about this particular piece, although I noticed that it was in the top 20 most emailed stories for several days after it appeared. So that's got to tell you something. But there was an interesting piece, I think it was in Digiday, that was talking about how native ads in general, at least according to Chartbeat, one of the companies that measures audiences, found that turns out that click-through rates are a lot lower than for the general content, and the likelihood of clicking away before you scroll down and read much content is a lot higher for the average piece of native content. This is not average.
This isn't, in the sense that people are so tuned in right now to Orange is the New Black, and that could be part of what makes it so successful, is the timing was so well done.
Well, not only timing, but, you know, Mike alludes to the concept of quality, and In advertising, would like to see things that are emailed to other people. The thing is, as journalists and advertising people know, producing high-quality material that is clickable, is shareable, is quality, it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's a hard thing to do. So it's something that's going to be really complex. And we also, we're talking about results. Marissa Meyer is in Cannes for the Advertising Lions Awards, but she was talking a lot, I think yesterday or the day before, about how this is a great brand-building capability and people should do their native advertising on Yahoo and those sorts of things. But we don't have very good data on your return on investment. So it sounds great. It's a great bunch of buzzwords, but does it really return something to the brand? That's very hard to measure.
How long would something like that take to be able to get measurements back on that? How much time do we have to let elapse to see?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to measure, because you can measure awareness, attitude, and behavior. Of course, we want behavior the most. That's the hardest to get. So it's hard to say if it rings the cash register. Okay. So it can be pretty quick. By shareability, but as far as translating to sales, not so clear.
So we mentioned the example quickly of the Scientology ad that was in The Atlantic. We also talked about last week's topic. We had talked about the American Express documentary ad, which if you missed that conversation from last week, you can find that on the links blog at kbia.org under the programs tab. You can watch that part of that conversation again and find links to that documentary. Who else is doing this either especially well or not so well at this time?
Well, I know I saw a really interesting piece that Cisco sponsored on Wired Magazine's tablet app this past month, and it's really good. It's about big data. It's got some game components to it. Yep. It's sort of a faux customization depending on what city you live in. It's really good. And I thought a couple of the other pieces on the New York Times of this new paid content service that they've set up are pretty good too by HP. They sponsored a couple of business-oriented pieces that weren't as elaborate in terms of their multimedia as this last one, but pretty good.
Okay. Forbes.com's doing interesting things. Condé Nast is getting in late to the party with all of their magazines, though some individual brands have done it. What their main focus is if they can do a lot of interesting native content that is adjacent to content that is related, they're going to be able to upsell to its existing advertisers. So that's their goal.
Okay. Well, for all that the New York Times has done to make it perfectly clear that the content in that section is paid for, in this case, we've seen a little bit something different from CNN this week. Now the network is taking heat for a documentary it ran during primetime Sunday night.
41 Americans come together.
What's always struck me is the joy he takes in his family.
To bring you the man you thought you knew.
Best stuff is when he leaves a message on your phone. Hey, Mike.
And the stories you won't forget.
Not gut, nip, bop, boop.
George Bush took himself lightly and took his responsibilities to help his fellow man seriously.
41 on 41. Sunday, June 15th at 9 on CNN.
On the surface of it, 41 on 41 looks like a pretty interesting look at the life and legacy of President George H.W. Bush, designed to coincide with his 90th birthday and Father's Day. But what CNN failed to acknowledge in that promo or in any of its run-up to the film's airing is that it was paid for by the George Bush Presidential Library Foundation. One of the producers is a former Bush speechwriter from his time in the White House. You also saw some of the 41 people who laud the man, Presidents Barack Obama and George W. Bush, actor Dana Carvey, well, Marlon Fitzwater, Dan Quayle, and John Sununu. They're also making appearances there. Now, there's a documentary that's been it has the potential to be politically charged. It's been paid for by a political organization, and it's running on CNN, the cable news network. Does that present a problem?
I mean, it also ran on his 90th birthday on Father's Day weekend. Did you really think it was going to be a hard-charging look at all of the problems of George H.W. Bush? Of course not. And this is what happens when former presidents get to be of a certain age, or we're worried about them passing, or they do pass. Even journalists, let alone the presidential libraries, tend to let them bask in the glow for a while. So this isn't really all that unusual or troubling to me anyway.
Yeah, I think it's symptomatic of something larger at CNN, which is it doesn't know what it is anymore. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think it would have been fine for them to be more transparent about doing this, and I don't think it would have diminished it in any way, but it could have given you a little bit of an alert. But they seem to be trying everything. I know we'll have fancy graphics. We'll have John King do something strange. We'll try anything in a completely non-strategic scramble for ratings. They throw some up against the wall. Well, that didn't seem to work. Let's try something else.
I mean, I do think that they have a strategy. Whether it's a good strategy or not, I don't know. I mean, they are trying to get beyond the story of the day and the incessant sameness of the way that cable television news covers the news. And I kind of applaud them for that. I mean, I like Anthony Bourdain being on CNN. I like some of the other documentaries and programs they've run. This one doesn't bother me near as much as the one you brought to our attention a couple of weeks ago in Chicago.
With Chicagoland, which was the eight or nine part, right, where Chicago Tribune investigation by Bill Ruthart showed that there was collaboration and collusion between Rahm Emanuel, his administration, and the producers of that program to stage and coordinate events.
And I've got to say, I mean, I do think CNN has done some questionable things. On the other hand, they tried, at least they're perceived as having tried over the years, to be the brand in the middle against MSNBC or Fox. They've tried to be the brand that does, you know, hard-hitting reporting and investigations. Where's it gotten them with audience? Not very far. Would I rather see them do more of that and less of the same old? Sure. As a second choice, would I be okay with them doing more documentaries and special programs instead of the same old? Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to talk for a minute about the San Antonio sports writer who was in Miami last week covering the NBA Finals, and he decided it was time to get a haircut.
Being in enemy territory, I was a little nervous about what my Spurs design would look like. And the last thing I need is a Miami Heat logo on the back of my head.
I am the first Spurs fan that you've done this year.
If I were the first and only, you'd probably sanction in with this situation right now, because on the average, you probably wouldn't even do it.
But after more than an hour in the chair, Torres and Danny the Barber hooked me up with the design Spurs Nation could be proud of, even if it was done by a Heat fan.
So I guess it's pretty lucky for him that the Spurs ended up winning the NBA championship. But in all seriousness, that presents a bit of a credibility problem for a sports reporter covering the team when he has the team's logo carved in the back of his hair, no?
I'm feeling like such an apologist this week. But I mean, you know, sports reporters or local reporters being homers for the team. Wow, what a concept. We even preach here at the Missouri School of Journalism now that local media have to be more engaged with their local community. Well, that's pretty engaging if you can get the San Antonio Spurs into your haircut. I don't have a problem with sports reporters doing it. I don't even have a problem with him, who is not a sports reporter, doing it. If it were on some other more controversial story, okay, but you know, this is fine.
Yeah, I think your point about community is really important. I mean, one of the things that's an interesting exercise to do if you're kind of a nerd like me, which is when the home team wins. No, I'm not going to do that yet. Is look at what the local winning team, how that's reported, and then go to the other town or city and see how that's reported. Now, when UConn won the NCAA championship, the headline in the Hartford Courant is, Champions, UConn takes the stairs to NCAA Mountaintop. Well, that isn't just really a neutral kind of effort. Cotton Bowl. I think we're about done. In both situations, they're much different kinds of reporting, and it reflects community interest and mores, and I can't get too upset about it.
Well, thank you. Thank you both. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today. Check out our links blog. Find it under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Hope Kerwin is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.